From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
Tonight, Florida executes its third prisoner in 9 months, despite protests from groups like the Florida Catholic Conference.
None of these decisions are easy for Governor Scott. He has said on numerous occasions that he prays about each one of these decisions.
Lawmakers are moving forward with Governor Scott's proposed business tax breaks, regardless of concerns.
I just don't feel that now is the right time to give tax breaks to large corporations that don't really need them, while we're instead cutting health care for seniors and for kids.
A bill that calls for the mandatory drug testing of state employees gets put on hold. And you'll hear why your ability to roll your own cigarettes could go up in smoke. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. Florida just executed its third convicted killer in 9 months, which has triggered the age-old debate over capital punishment. Jessica Palumbo of member station WJCT in Jacksonville reports that both supporters and opponents of the death penalty say they rely on their faith to guide them.
Her name was Deborah Kammerer. She was 29 years old and had 3 children. On January 2, 1980, her body washed up on the shore of Tampa Bay. Robert Waterhouse, a convicted murderer who is out on parole, was eventually convicted of raping and brutally murdering her. Last month, after 31 years of appeals, Governor Rick Scott signed his death warrant. Waterhouse died by lethal injection this evening. Florida executes about 2 inmates each year, and with every execution come the protests.
We recognize the state has the right to exact punishment on offenders.
That's Sheila Hopkins of the Florida Catholic Conference. The group had sent a letter signed by all of Florida's bishops that urged Scott to stay Waterhouse's execution.
We believe that it's better to, rather than execute them, you know, to just keep them in prison for the rest of their life.
In the letter, the bishop said the rate of executions, one for every 3 of the past 9 months, was, quote, alarming.
We're just kind of concerned that he, you know, is continuing to execute at what would be a fairly rapid pace from past practices.
Governor Scott has met with the group and heard their concerns, but his press secretary, Lane Wright, says ultimately the governor has a constitutional duty to uphold Florida law.
None of these decisions are easy for Governor Scott. He has said on numerous occasions that he prays about each one of these decisions to make sure he's doing the right thing. But when it comes down to it, this is the law, and he is fulfilling his duty.
Florida is one of 34 states with the death penalty. Joan Marie Davily, a professor at Florida Coastal School of Law, says, in theory, capital punishment is both retribution for the victims and a deterrent for would-be criminals. But in decades-long cases like Waterhouse's, she says she doubts it will deter anyone.
I don't know how many inmates or people out about to murder are that worried about what's going to happen in 32 years.
Waterhouse was one of 395 inmates on Florida's death row. Many of them committed their crimes in the 1970s. Palm Beach Post columnist Frank Carabino says more death row inmates die of natural causes than from being executed.
The reality is that people spend decades on death row, and it ends up costing the taxpayers more than if they were just sentenced to life in prison from the start.
With the appeals process, a life on death row ends up costing the state 3 times as much as life imprisonment, Carabino says. But a set of bills that have been introduced in the Florida legislature might ease that cost by foreseeably making the death penalty less common in Florida. Under current law, death sentences are determined by a simple majority of the jury, but the bills would require a jury to unanimously recommend a death sentence. If one juror dissented, a life sentence would apply. Those bills, sponsored by Representative John Julian of North Miami Beach and Senator Oscar Brainin of Miami Gardens, have not been heard by committee since they were introduced last month. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Lawmakers in the Florida House are looking into legislation that would give tax breaks to businesses in the state. Regan McCarthy reports legislators are considering a measure that combines several of Governor Rick Scott's business tax initiatives, like doubling the corporate income tax exemption. It's a move that would let thousands of businesses skip the tax that Scott says will lead to more jobs.
Representative Steve Precourt says most lawmakers agree one of their main goals in Tallahassee should be to garner job growth. And Precourt, a Republican from Orlando, says his proposal would do exactly that.
It contains significant tax relief for Floridians, exquisite economic development incentives that will help our current economy, and bureaucratic streamlining that will make the whole process work that much better. And these are things that Floridians need now.
The measure would allow a number of tax cuts for businesses by increasing the corporate income tax exemption from $25,000 to $50,000, repealing the sales tax on certain products used to make airplane and gas turbines, and exempting packing houses from sales tax on electricity usage. But Representative Richard Steinberg, a Democrat from Miami Beach, disagrees with Representative Precourt about the bill's purpose.
If this bill was about creating jobs, then there was an amendment yesterday that would have been very friendly. It was an amendment that said, in order to qualify for that tax break, you had to increase the number of Floridians that you employed. If we're really here to create jobs, that would have been a very friendly amendment. But instead, it was blocked by a procedural move, by placing an amendment that had already been adopted on top of that amendment.
Steinberg filed one of several amendments to the bill yesterday, most of which would have put more qualifications in place in order for a business to receive the tax benefits. But Representative Carlos Lopez Cantera, a Republican from Miami, says he doesn't think those amendments were genuine.
This bill was heard in committee. This bill had second reading, third reading. It went through the entire process. And a lot of these ideas, I just don't believe, came to people at the moment that it could have been on the floor, that it came to the floor. There was ample opportunity in committee to address these issues.
The amendments were made mostly by Democrats and were generally not accepted by the Republican majority. However, Republicans did respond with their own amendment, a requirement that companies must not employ union members in order to qualify for the tax exemptions. The amendment put forward by Lopez Cantera was used several times to replace amendments proposed by Democrats and is now a reason some, like Representative Joseph Abruzzo, a Democrat from Wellington, say they can't get behind the bill as a whole.
I believe that this is a good bill. I believe that this bill puts us in a position in this country where other states are raising their corporate taxes and businesses are fleeing. This puts Florida in a position to pick up large corporations and the jobs that go with it and keep those in Florida here. Unfortunately, with the amendment tacked on that goes against labor and our working people in Florida, I cannot support it right now.
Some go so far as to say the amendment is unconstitutional. Others, like Representative Jeff Clemons, a Democrat from Lake Worth, are raising different concerns. Clemons says the measure isn't focused enough on small businesses.
The truth of the matter is that this bill doesn't benefit small businesses because most small businesses are subchapter S or LLCs. This benefits large corporations or the subsidiaries of large corporations. And I just don't feel that now is the right time to give tax breaks to large corporations that don't really need them while we're instead cutting health care for seniors and for kids.
The proposal, which would result in more than $120 million in business tax breaks, passed through the House with a 92-22 vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, we learn how a fight over the University of South Florida Polytechnic School could derail the Senate's budget plan.
First of all, I think his accusations outrageous, but not supported by the facts.
A bill that calls for the random drug testing of state workers died today, but only for a brief moment.
I can understand the need to drug test randomly those people in sensitive positions, but just randomly testing anybody who works for the state, I have real questions that would hold up in court.
And a House committee votes to close a tax loophole enjoyed by roll-your-own tobacco shops.
Do you believe the rhetoric that you're saying? Because obviously this has been told to you. But most of the items that you're saying up there are so far from the truth.
The Senate Budget Committee hearing almost broke down today over a battle to fund the University of South Florida and its Polytechnic campus. Lynn Hatter reports after hours of blistering criticism, the Senate backed off a plan to hold back money from USF until it handed over Polytechnic as part of a plan to eventually make the campus an independent university.
The Senate's budget for higher education takes $400 million away from universities and directs the schools to use their savings to make up the difference. Under the reduction plan, the state's largest universities, Florida State, the University of Florida, and the University of Central Florida, would take a one-time cut of between 25 to 30%. But one school, the University of South Florida, seemed to be taking a greater share of that cut.
First of all, I think his accusations outrageous, but and not supported by the facts.
USF is embroiled in a fight with Senate Budget Chairman J.D. Alexander over its Polytech campus, which wants to become an independent school. Alexander supports those plans, and enclosed in the higher ed budget was an additional $25 million holdback provision that Senator Evelyn Lynn said was meant to speed up the separation process.
That money is intended for the University of South Florida, and that will be held in abeyance, but will absolutely be returned once the separation by USF from Poly is completed.
The higher education budget also includes language that calls for an immediate separation of USF and its Polytech. The Polytech money, another $35 million, will be taken from USF once the two schools are separate. There's also the cost of absorbing Polytech's faculty back into the main campus. In all, the University of South Florida would have lost closer to 60% of its state funding. But Senate President-designate Don Gates said the budget cuts wouldn't affect the university's day-to-day operations, since most of it is coming from savings.
The funds that are being swept are functionally funds that are in unrestricted reserves, like we sweep other unrestricted reserves around the state. It's my impression that your proposal does not reduce by $1 the operating funds that are available to carry out the academic programs of our universities.
Students and even the university's president, Judy Genshaft, have been at the Capitol this week talking with legislators. Lawmakers like Republican Jim Norman of Tampa blasted the budget and its writers.
I would love for you to set aside $25 million out of your university for any reason. My point is, this acceleration is on the backs of these students that are in college, and you don't bargain futures like this, even in this appropriations process.
The Senate's budget proposal showed that USF's cut, minus costs associated with the Polytech, was only slightly higher than other schools. But Lynn says the Polytech controversy had confused the budget and policy issues.
And I think we're trying to mix apples and oranges. We have to take each one as a separate issue. The funding issue is hitting all of the universities across the board.
Still, Norman wanted to know why the chamber was including the split language in the budget in the first place.
The Board of Governors set up a step plan. Has there been any noncompliance that we have feel as a Senate that we have to take this action to make sure that they do comply?
And Alexander laid out a long list of grievances against USF.
Starting with the dismissal of the campus chancellor, who had prepared the plan as requested by the chair and vice chair of the Board of Governors, along with a number of the senior staff there that were also dismissed, and ultimately who had written the plan that the Board of Governors approved to be done.
USF's $25 million funding holdback was ultimately dropped from the Senate's plan. The money now goes back into the university's general revenue fund and moves the total budget cut closer to that of the rest of the larger universities. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. A bill that would have required state employees to submit to a random drug test narrowly escaped death, at least for now. As Sasha Cordner reports, the bill initially failed to pass in a House budget panel due to worries over its constitutionality, but it was later revived.
Currently, the state is embroiled in a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union. The group is challenging an executive order issued by Governor Rick Scott last year, calling for the mandatory drug testing of some state employees. But that did not stop Republican Representative Jimmy Smith of Lecanto from filing legislation to make it law.
HB 1205 amends the Drug-Free Workplace Act to authorize random drug testing of public employees once every 3 months. These tests be selected by random computer generation, and also authorize pre-employment drug testing of all public job applicants, as all people, when under the influence of drugs, are dangerous to the public safety.
But Pamela Birch Fort with ACLU of Florida says subjecting public employees to universal suspicionless drug testing is clearly unconstitutional.
The United States Supreme Court has previously ruled that universal, random, suspicionless drug testing of employees by government, absent a safety-sensitive job, violates the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which protects against unreasonable search and seizure. House Bill 1205 subjects state employees to suspicionless, universal drug testing and therefore violates the Constitution.
Smith's bill also failed to muster any support among most of the lawmakers on the House Appropriations Committee. Democratic Representative Martin Kerr of Davie says it doesn't make sense to move forward with legislation because in addition to the U.S. Supreme Court case, the staff analysis cited two other cases that show the bill is unconstitutional.
The other two are Florida Federal District Court cases, one from the Northern District of Florida and one from the Southern District of Florida, with both made conditions of employment, had universal suspicionless drug testings as conditions of state employment, and the courts have all ruled that it is unconstitutional to do that.
The bill's staff analysis doesn't specify how much random drug testing would cost taxpayers, and House Democratic Leader Ron Saunders says not only is he troubled by the bill's potential for lawsuits, he's also concerned that the bill's sponsor and even the staff analysis could not show the fiscal impact.
I think it's not responsible for us to be passing a bill that we cannot determine the cost of the drug test, how many people apply. Since you've made it so broad, which makes it, I think, unconstitutional, you've also made it so broad that you're putting a very big responsibility on the state to be responsible for something that we don't know the cost.
Smith's bill also received opposition from several of his Republican colleagues, including Representative Bill Proctor of St. Augustine.
I can understand the need to drug test randomly those people in sensitive positions, or even perhaps those where the employer has cause to believe. But just randomly testing anybody who works for the state, I have real questions that would hold up in court. I'm not a lawyer, but I want to see some case law that addresses that issue.
When the bill came up for a vote, it initially failed. However, in a surprise move, a motion was called to reconsider the vote.
So Representative Coley moves to reconsider the vote by which the bill passed. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
The panel agreed to postpone the bill until further notice. It's unclear if they're taking the ACLU's suggestion and waiting on the outcome of the court case scheduled for Wednesday, February 22nd, in the Southern District Court of Florida on the constitutionality of the governor's executive order. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Now here's Ronald J. Eben with a look at some of the action around the Capitol tomorrow.
The House will be in session from 3 to 6 p.m. on Thursday. The Senate Banking and Insurance Committee meets at 8 a.m. One of the bills under consideration involves child support payments. The Senate Commerce and Tourism Committee considers a bill involving employees who are paid with a combination of tips and hourly wages. Thursday is Gator Day at the Capitol, with U.S. President Bernie Machen among the speakers at a luncheon. The Senate Health Regulation Committee will consider a number of bills regarding abortion, including one that requires a physician who performs abortions to complete continuing education related to ethics. And State University System Chancellor Frank Brogan and representatives of at least four universities will be at the Capitol to honor hundreds of Florida's top high school STEM students at an event that will showcase their accomplishments. The event sponsored by the Florida Education Association. And that's the daybook for Thursday, February 16th.
Finally, rolling your own could go up in smoke if a proposal moving through the legislature becomes law. James Call reports the House Finance and Tax Committee today voted to tax cigarettes rolled automatically at convenience stores, the same rate as those sold by major manufacturers like Philip Morris and the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company.
Kissimmee Representative Mike Horner is sponsoring the bill. It closes a loophole which tobacco shops use to avoid paying some state and federal taxes. Currently, a consumer pays about $20 less in taxes on a carton of cigarettes at a roll-your-own shop than he does when he buys a name brand. A brigade of store owners, employees, and lobbyists followed Horner out of the committee room after his proposal received a unanimous vote.
I'm going to respond to you.
Jay Goldberg is with Let It Roll, which operates five shops throughout Central Florida. He disputed Horner's testimony before the committee.
Do you believe the rhetoric that you're saying? Because obviously this has been told to you. But most of the items that you're saying up there are so far from the truth.
Goldberg and others challenge Horner's facts on just about everything. Horner contends that the roll-your-own industry exists because the state imposed higher taxes on cigarettes a couple years ago. He also says by acquiring up to 2% of the market share, the roll-your-own storefronts have cannibalized jobs.
I believe everything I'm saying. I believe that, this, you exist, my opinion is, this didn't exist prior to these taxes going in place. The reason your customers come to you is because it's much less expensive to buy from you than to buy from a typical retail.
People willing to spend time making their own cigarettes using automated rolling machines in the store reduce by more than two-thirds the amount of tax they pay at checkout. The rolling machines and cheaper smokes have ignited debates across the country. Legislatures in Indiana and Virginia have debated similar bills this month. The Associated Press reports roll-your-own stores in New York closed amidst a variety of concerns. Frank Mayernick told the committee that it's unfair to subject storefront entrepreneurs to the same regulations as those imposed on major manufacturers who produce iconic brands like Winston and Marlboro. He says people have been using machines to roll cigarettes since at least the 1930s.
But they're renting these machines, like going into a laundromat. They're renting the machines. They're doing it themselves. They walk in, they pick out their pipe tobacco, their loose tobacco, their papers. They put it in the machine. They press a button. They are rolling their own cigarettes in a store now and doing a little bit more efficiently. Now, to compare us to a manufacturer, a cigarette manufacturer can make 20,000 cigarettes in 1 minute.
The automated rollers can produce up to 20 cigarettes a minute. One store employee estimates his shop produces up to 60 cartons a day. And Let It Roll's Jay Goldberg says his stores pay a lot of taxes.
We have a tax called the OTP tax, other tobacco product tax, that we pay 60% at our wholesale number, plus a 25% surcharge, which when you average that out, $100 of wholesale product costs me $175. Other states around us, Ohio, 17% with no surcharge. Pennsylvania, zero. Tennessee, 6.6%. Georgia, 10%. And Louisiana, 33% with no surcharges. So we do pay a fair share of taxes for what we do.
There are about 110 tobacco shops in the state with automated rolling machines. And although the machines collectively can produce tens of thousands of cartons of cigarettes a day, industry spokespeople say they are not manufacturers. They say the stores simply rent the jukebox-sized rolling machines to consumers who like to roll their own. Horner sees things differently.
This isn't entrepreneurship and somebody came up with a better mousetrap, a better way to make tobacco. We heard lots of testimony that the cigarettes stink. So it's not a better product. It's a tax dodge. The mousetrap was, we're going to come out with a way of gaming the system. This didn't exist until the state decided to create this exorbitant sin tax, and now these folks have come up with a way to game the system. It only exists for one reason, to escape your tax liability.
The committee agreed with Horner and passed the bill. It has one more committee stop. A similar Senate bill has yet to be heard in committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm James Call.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are James Call, Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tremel Gomes, inviting you to join us each weeknight for more reports from the state capitol.